hear people talking right about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, lead it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you run down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program. We're going to play a recent program by Andrew Carrington Hitchcock and Paul English. They don't want you to have free speech, so they invented the term hate speech to shut you up. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Play this for you right now.
The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of Andrew Carrington Hitchcock, the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction of our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Thank you. And now it's time for the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show.
Hello everybody, and before we start the show today, I would like to thank George for his recent donation. And the title of today's show is "They Don't Want You to Have Free Speech, So They Invented the Term Hate Speech to Shut You Up." It's a bit of a mouthful, folks, but it's one of the great memes that you will find on Snippets and Snappets website, and that is Snippets-and-Slappets, okay? slslappets.blogspot.com. So snippets-and-slappets.blogspot.com. If I remember, I will put a link to this in the post of the show. And of course, this is the Tuesday show with my co-host Paul English. I'm going to bring him up right now. Paul, are you with me?
I am with you, Andrew, and good to be with you again. This week rolls round quickly, doesn't it?
It does, and I must say I thought that you and Maleficus and Adrian did a fantastic job on Fake News Now last week. Folks, if you go to eurofolkradio.com, you can find that on the website for download. And there was also a caller, Mark, called in, and I didn't realise that he was Mark who's been in touch with me a few times, and he sent me some very nice emails, and he listens to this show, and so it was good to hear a caller, because of course I don't record live, so I don't have a call-in facility, so it was good that he had that facility to speak to you both, and I think the whole show was quite a refreshing experience. How did you find it went?
Yeah, it was it was good. I think inadvertently it was kind of a pilot for something I've been thinking about and probably, you know, whittering on to you about for the past couple of months, but I'm definitely planning on developing something pretty quickly as soon as I've got some sort of forward programming planned. It was really, I like very much the idea that we can take calls in, and although Mark was the only caller in, this is not surprising because we only made people aware of the phone number about an hour and a half before the show went live. And his call was excellent. It was great to just get that interaction with people. And it's a strength of radio, which to some degree, I suppose, we could make far more use of, and I'm intending to really in the weeks and months going ahead. It makes for a lighter load as well as the show host in many ways, because you get people coming in, you know, either, well, augmenting the arguments or the discussion and or opposing parts of it, which is fine. I don't have a problem with any of that. I think sometimes it's good grist for the mill, as they say. Maleficus, of course, we interviewed here, didn't we, a couple of months ago, or a month back or so, over his grandfather's book, predominantly Hidden Government, which is worth plugging again and again, because I'm still slightly jealous of him, Andy. You know, having a grandfather that wrote a book like that is a marvellous thing to have in your family tree. So I'm very impressed with that, and always will be. And Adrian was excellent. I've yet to catch up with him since then. I hope we didn't tire him out. I don't think we did. As people who heard the show, he's an elderly gentleman, but his brain is as sharp as a razor, and he was wonderful to talk to, and we're hoping to feature him on a regular basis. So we're just trying to work something out so that we can provide his viewpoint. I suppose a little bit like many people over here will recall. There was a journalist called Alistair Cook, came from Lancashire, but he spent most of his life in New York. And he really developed a sort of transatlantic accent. And he used to do a radio show for the BBC for years, I mean decades, called Alistair Cook's Letter from America. It was only about 20 minutes long. I used to think it was longer than that, but it turned out it was about 20 minutes long. He used to run once a week. And he used to provide these extremely pithy, detailed, highly incisive sort of reports on the cultural and political state of America at the time, and he would do it obviously from an English perspective because he couldn't do anything else, and it made for compelling listening. And well, hopefully Adrian's going to be sending us a letter from London, as it were, because that's where he's based, so we will see, but we're going to try and develop something along those lines.
That sounds very interesting, and I also wanted to mention your appearance this weekend just gone on our mutual friend Dennis Fetcho's show, Inside the Eye Live, his flagship Saturday show. You did the second hour with Thomas Goodrich, plugging the audio book of Hellstorm. You also played a clip from that. It's always nice to hear the three of you together. And I want to let the audience know where they can get Hellstorm. But firstly, can you just run through that show for us, folks? If you want to get it, you go to InsideTheEyeLive.com and you'll be able to download it there. And so talk us through that, Paul, and then how people can get hold of the audiobook of Hellstorm.
Yeah, I actually, when was I last done with Dennis? It's not as if I'm on all the time, but I've got to know him quite well since then, probably last year. He's had Tom on a few times. I think he had Tom on in January or February of this year, and he knew that we'd got this audiobook out, so he asked us to come back on. By the way, just backtracking to the previous question, don't worry, I'll come back in here. I just wanted to thank Mark for his call. You mentioned him. It was great to interact with you, Mark, if you're hearing this. It's absolutely fantastic. And it's like breaking the agreement. Hopefully we can get more and more people calling in, giving different views from, you know, their obvious obviously they're different perspectives. It's very useful. But yes, to coming back to Dennis, it was it's always a breeze being with him. You've been with him. You have him on now, don't you? He's a regular guest on Fridays, and he's very fluid and deals with things in his own particular way, and he's it makes it very easy listening, and this is part of the key, I think, to getting the message across in a more effective way. So yeah, he had me and Tom on. We were talking about this audio book that I've read, as it were, of the book, Hellstorm audiobook. And the website's hellstormaudiobook.com. That's the shameless self-promotion department bit out of the way. But that's what we were talking about. We played a clip. But the interesting thing, Andy, was, to me as well, outside of our show, this middle segment that we did, and I think we've got it on replay later today on EFR. It's coming up, I think, a bit later today. Yeah, it is, actually. Without all the adverts in, so we get it. The show, the ads removed, that runs for about 2.5 hours, something like that. So that's on later this afternoon. We're replaying Dennis's shows a couple of times a week because they make for very good listening. But after, I don't know if you call the guest after him, which I think probably to some degree is going to dovetail in perfectly with what we're talking about today. Not that this is an uncommon topic to talk about, but the woman that he had on was called, or is called, Georgia Peach. Now, it's obviously a... It's a very nice show name, and I'd not heard her before, but Tom Goodrich had made me aware of her because we were due to go on her radio show to talk about the audiobook about a month back. And at the time, literally just at the time when we were about to go on, I think it was that weekend coming up, a few days before that, she was relieved of her post, or sacked, as we would say over here. She was relieved of her post. And this was because the station's owners, although they were Jewish, I believe, had come under considerable pressure from the ADL and probably the SPLC, who'd been pressing them for a long time to get rid of her, because she was basically, and is, an extremely coherent and delightful voice to listen to regarding championing white people. And this was, of course, resented bitterly. And apparently, I don't know exactly what the precise background is to it, Andrew, but they found some means of being able to put sufficient pressure onto the station to have a remove, which must have been a bit of a blow, because from the discussion, and this is a California, was it San Diego, San Jose, somewhere like that? It's a Santa Cruz. It's one of the Santa Cruz, sorry. Okay. I was guessing, I was going to go through the whole of the ones I knew, which isn't many. She was like their top, amongst their top rated show hosts. In terms of listener count, and so it was a very interesting interview. I liked, it's wonderful to hear things from, as I keep saying, from different perspectives. She was very clear about it, and you know, the point she made, which I thought was, it won't be new to anybody around here, but it's worth repeating again, is that every group, excuse me, every group have got a platform on which to speak, but when white people speak about their own interests, this is to be demonized, and you have to be throttled back and shut up. It's not going to happen much longer. We're not going to be throttled and shut up. And in fact, you know, we are kind of evidence. We're the symptom of that. We're one of the symptoms of it here. Not the only one, of course. They're springing up everywhere and getting more effective. But I love the interview with her. So I don't know what she's doing. I'd love to find some way of giving her a home somewhere, audio-wise. But I think from Dennis, he was saying she's resting for a while, which is understandable. But she understood, you know, and nailed all the arguments. And I'm not trying to sound patronizing here. When we get a female voice talking about it, it adds considerably to the color of what we can talk about. So we want, you know, we're really looking for people of both men and women and of different age, you know, running up and down the age ranges to talk about this issue from that perspective, because it helps all of us. We're all in this together. There isn't an age divide. There isn't a gender divide in terms of ensuring, you know, that we are not demoralized, that we remain encouraged during this period and keep pressing on. So I thought he had a cracking show on Saturday. I mean, of course, we were on it. That was the best. But no, overall, it was a great show on Saturday. So I thought Dennis had it. It was one of his best ones I've heard for quite a while. It was fantastic.
Yeah, he always puts good work together. I mean, when I dropped down to 5 shows a week, of course, I've got you as a regular co-host, Pastor Eli, and Pastor Steve as regular co-host, and Adrian Creek. So it only gives me 2 shows to play with. If I had the other 2 shows that I dropped to play with, I wouldn't hesitate in asking Dennis to join me every Friday. But what I'm trying to do, for a couple of reasons as well, firstly, Dennis is very busy. And so at the moment, he's on a bit of a hiatus. The year in Saudi Arabia is finished, so he's in Jordan, so it's easier to get hold of him. But there has been occasions where he's had to let me know 3-4 days before, which gives me plenty of time to find someone else. But, you know, he's got a business commitment that's come up. And what I'm doing is I'm alternating him with Dr. Peter Hammond, who's also very popular. And that's working out quite well at the moment. And a recent time when Dennis couldn't make it, I got in touch with Peter and he was able to jump in. So the plan is to alternate them, so they each do a Friday every couple of weeks. And it makes for the show to be, you know, something hopefully people look forward to, because it's not coming every week. The other thing I wanted to touch on was I was sent a clip, again by a mutual friend of ours, Chris Wright, in Australia. And it's quite an interesting clip because a guy from the UK, from Yorkshire area, in fact they asked him where he's from, is he from Leeds, I think they say at the start of the thing. I think he's filming...
Far too close to home, Andrew.
Yes, he's filming John Howard on the street. Now, John Howard won't be familiar to a lot of people outside of Australia, but for people in Australia, this is the first paragraph from his Wikipedia page. John Winston Howard, interesting, is an Australian former politician who served as the 25th Prime Minister of Australia from 1996 to 2007, so that's 11 years. That's the equivalent of Thatcher in the UK. He is the second longest serving Australian Prime Minister, behind only Sir Robert Menzies, who was in office for over 18 years. He is also the oldest living former Australian Prime Minister. As of 16th of May 2019, Howard was leader of the Liberal Party from 1985 to 1989 and from 1995 to 2007. And so this is quite a raw clip because it's on the street. It's got video as well, which I'm just obviously going to play the audio to you. I had the actual file sent to me, so I can't link it anywhere to you to watch the video, but it is very up and down because, you know, the guy's following him down the street. I will say there is a profanity that's used in the clip, so any of you that don't want to hear that, I think it's a couple of minutes long, so just tune out for a couple of minutes. But Paul, if you're ready, I'll mute us both and I'll play the clip for your comments. You ready?
Sure. By the way, who does the profanity? Is it John Howard or the lad from Leeds?
No, it's the lad from Leeds. If it was John Howard,
oh, I'd be shocked. I'm ashamed.
But
roll it, Andy.
Absolutely. Okay, here we go, folks. Right, let me cue everything up. I'll mute Paul, and here's the video.
What's your name?
Alex.
When did you arrive in Australia?
About a month and a half ago.
Yeah. Okay, where are you from? The north of England?
Yeah.
North of England.
Leeds?
Near there.
Where are you? What's your name?
My name's John Howard.
Have you been a Prime Minister?
What happened? I got booted out.
Oh,
isn't it? Was you corrupt?
Oh, thanks, buddy. Yeah. Yeah. Prime
Minister. Have you got money offshore as well?
Yeah.
Have you got money offshore as well? Are you a Freemason?
Yeah.
So, are you against the occupation of Palestine?
I'm a strong supporter of Israel.
So, you're therefore... Well,
I don't wish to engage in a discussion, if you don't mind.
So, you're a strong supporter of Israel?
Strong supporter of Israel.
But are you a strong supporter of Palestine as well?
Yes. Thanks.
You're a strong supporter of Israel and Palestine? Do you want to see peace in the Middle East?
We all have peace.
Do you reckon Zionism's racist?
No, it's not.
Are you for Zionism?
I'm for an independent...
Do you know how Israel was created? It was,
I know
it was the Balfour Declaration. We signed it to the Rothschild family, mate.
Yeah, I know a lot about it.
So, okay, you remember...
I think we've had a long enough discussion.
I don't think we've had a long enough discussion.
Yeah.
Are you a Freemason?
Mind your own business.
You are a Freemason. Mahabone. Do you have a little Freemason handshake? Do you not jaywalk? If you used to be the Prime Minister, what do you think to Tony Blair? Do you reckon he should go to The Hague?
He's a good man.
Tony Blair's a good man, he's a war criminal. What about George Bush? Do you think he's a good man?
Excellent man.
He's an absolute cunt. In my eyes, anyway.
Yeah.
And the eyes of all the millions of Iraqis, all the children that are obviously, unfortunately, not here anymore. Are you going in here? All the best for the future, John. Free Palestine!
Well, there you go, folks. You don't get much more raw video than that. Paul, I mean, obviously, John Howard acknowledged when he said about the Balfour Declaration and the Rothschild family, I know all about it. He wouldn't answer the question about being a Freemason, so that would cause us to infer that he probably is. But of course, he may just want to keep these things to himself, and you could see that he didn't have a lot of regard for this guy. I think at the start of the video, he was quite friendly, talked to people on the street, and when he saw it was going to start getting political and getting difficult politically, that he just wanted to avoid the question. And that's exactly what this show is kind of linked to last week's show, which was called Comments of Disabled for this video, because these people don't want any rhetoric that goes against their official line. And that's why the title of today's show is they don't want you to have free speech, so they invented the term hate speech to shut you up. Because essentially, we've never had the media that we've got today, in the sense of we've got a form of dissident media that we can go out over the air, and that's why it's like whack-a-mole. They're trying to knock everyone out one after another, because people have finally got a media on the alternative. It doesn't tell them all the truth. There are people out there that we regard as shills or spreading malicious news for whatever business they have with it. But certainly we try to give people what's really going on out there. And they don't like it. They don't like the fact that they've spent all this money on their media apparatus, and now there are people out there that are saying, you know, the media's basically been lying to you. They know these things. They know who's in control. And I'm going to shut up now and hand over to you.
I couldn't stop laughing. I'm sorry. I know it was foul language. But, you know, there is an appropriate time to use foul language, actually. And that was one of them. I couldn't stop laughing because that's the sort of language I'm afraid I grew up in, everybody, as I grew up as a young man in Leeds, which is where I'm from. Excuse me, I've got this little tickly cough today. Also, the rawness of it is very powerful. I would imagine John Howard getting his wrist slapped by someone somewhere if that sort of thing goes on. He's definitely a Mason or whatever, because nobody at those levels is allowed to rise into positions of power without being one, i.e. without being part of some sort of brotherhood that can obviously apply leverage to them if he should get a bit too uppity and want to do things that would actually help, say, in this case, the Australian people. Outside of the plans that they've already laid down, you can't be going around doing that. It's not on, you see. So, but that is really effective. I mean, the fact that he engaged with the guy, obviously he thought he was probably in for a cheery street chat, like maybe people used to get 30 years ago when they were talking to us and we didn't know anything. Very different now. There's a lot of people really sharp on stuff. And this lad, I need to find out who he is. I'm going to get him on EFR. He can have a show as long as he doesn't use language like that on public broadcast, you know what I mean? Why not? But there's a tremendous energy in that little exchange. It's fantastic. I love that. I'm glad. I only listened to the first minute of it, actually, today, prior to the show, so it was wonderful to go through the whole thing. It was very fresh on my ears as you ran through it there. Yes, well, the great shuttering goes on, but I suspect that as fast as they shut one down, others are popping up. We're a bit like damp, really. I've got rid of it here. We're just going to bing, 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 like a fungus everywhere. A healthy damp, if you know what I mean. A healthy fungal infection to take this whole rotten building down, which is what's needed. And the lad made some very, very good points. I mean, the fact that John Howard would say that Tony Blair is a good man, at that point, any credibility that he may have been straining for in my ears just evaporated. I don't know a great deal about Australian politics. Yet, I suspect we're going to get to find out a bit more. We're going to find out about everything, really. But marvellous. What a marvellous little interview. That guy needs a show, to just confront him. And what I also liked was this sort of jocular laugh that was in the back of the throat of this lad. You could just tell he's sort of looking at him. He just wants to laugh his socks off at him. This is so powerful. These people are figures of ridicule and need to be portrayed more fully by us and others as such. That's exactly what they are. They are a joke, these people. They're not brighter than us. They don't know anything more necessary than we do. It's just that they've compromised on their lives, and so they get these positions of so-called power over us to a great degree. And when he was taking that approach with him, he effectively quoted me that with his trousers down. You know, they can't add to the mystique of the power of the whole thing when you've got some lad from Leeds on the street just laughing at you, calling your name, pointing out that what you're thinking is really, really stupid. So I love that. Highly effective. Imagine if we could get them all in a pub and have a real proper chat. They won't last 10 minutes. They won't last 10 minutes, these guys. I'm serious now, and not in a discussion or anything. We would make mincemeat of them, which is part of, you know, the whole of the stage management, the show, the distraction system that we have to endure, which is called the news. I mean, news studios these days, you know, I don't know how much they spend on these sets, but they're obviously designed for a purpose. They have, you know, they're seeking to project this competence in all areas. Well, you know, many of us could be competent if we've got a budget of £1 million a week to run a news show or whatever they spend on this stuff. You know, we could all come across pretty well. But they're heavily reliant on this. And what's occurring, of course, Andy, is that as dissident journalists, dissident broadcasters such as you and I and others, as we tunnel in to what they're doing, the story becomes simple. We strip away the emperor's clothes, and they seem to be working against the very interest they say they support. That they are against us. So John Howard said everything. He was like a gift, wasn't he? He couldn't have said anything better. He thinks the Balfour Declaration's fine. He supports Zionism. Tony Blair's a good guy, and so's George Bush. And you're going, wow, where did you come from? You're like a Christmas present. Keep talking. It's fantastic. Absolutely. What a wonderful dunce he turned out to be. And he's not obviously sharp as razors. He can tell. He's obviously, you know, he's got a bright intellect. But in terms of revealing the agenda, lovely. Thanks very much. Thanks very much, Mr. Howard. Marvellous.
Excellent. Well, again, thanks to Chris Wright for sending this on to me. And
thanks, Chris.
A video from Robbie. That's just the title. So Robbie, as I said, Paul said, if you're out there, fantastic work. And very brave to, you know, this sort of journalism that's done on the street. I'm a guy that sits in my apartment and I do these shows. I'm not someone that really goes out and about and does even things like the book, The Synagogue of Satan. It was all taken from sources that I've read. So it's going to be secondary at best, or tertiary, or even below that data that I did cross-reference. But I never actually went up to anybody individually and got things directly. And of course, when people are doing that, you're absolutely right, Paul, they take one of us out and someone else pops up. And so they have to come out with all this nonsense. Like last week, the Holocaust statement from the five different prime ministers. You know, they didn't want comments on the video because they didn't want people to put certain things in that are questions the likes of Alfred Schaefer have asked. And I think even if you took some people out there who completely believe that the official narrative of this event, then I think some of them would be shocked to hear that you've got a guy called Alfred Schaefer in a German prison who came up with evidence to the contrary, who is also going on trial again because he repeated the evidence he brought to the contrary in his trial, so he can be prosecuted twice. I mean, how you can reveal things that you believe in a court of law in order to justify your position and be found guilty of a crime. I think most people would find this pretty disgusting when they're telling us that we have free speech. And this kind of takes us to the genesis of hate speech. And we go back, I've read this on the show with you before, I don't know how long ago it was, but it's really worth touching on. And it's from the Synagogue of Satan here. It is from 1988. And let's look at the, yeah, here we are. So 31 years ago, the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, initiated a nationwide competition for law students to draft anti-hate legislation designed to protect minority groups. That competition is won by a man named Joseph Ribicoff, whose proposals stipulate that not only must hate-motivated violence be banned, but any words which stimulate suspicion, friction, hate and possible violence must also be criminalised. This ADL prize-winning paper suggests that not only should state agencies monitor and restrict free speech in general, but they should also censor all films that criticise identifiable groups. Furthermore, even if the person making the statement can justify it, for example, Christians criticising homosexuality because the Bible expressly forbids it, Ribicoff asserts that the truth is to be no defence in court. Where have we heard that before? The only proof a court will need in order to secure a conviction of hate speech is that something has been said and a minority group or member of such group has felt emotionally damaged as a result of such criticism. Therefore, under these proposals, which the ADL will have forced into law all over the world less than 15 years later, through their bought and paid for politicians and media, Jesus Christ would have been arrested as a hate criminal. Well, he pretty much was, and he was put to death. But if you take, for example, the international definition of anti-Semitism, and you take the part in which they say about their control of the media, mendacious statements about our control of the media, why can't we take that and a copy of the LA Times article by Joel Stein, in which he admits that they control the media, Wall Street, government and Hollywood, why can't we take that to the police in this country and say, look, laws are being forced through in this country, and I've got evidence here that shows these laws are based on lies. But we don't even feel comfortable to do this. I can't believe that I'm having to say, as a former police officer myself, that I can't even take evidence of underhandedness and lies and corruption to the police force and expect it to be investigated and dealt with correctly. But I can't, and I'm sure the audience will agree with me all around the world, we can't do that. We have the evidence, oh, shut up. You know, this is the system, this is what you're going to live under. We're going to tell you what's true and what's false. And if you don't, we're going to threaten. And if you don't go along with it, we're going to threaten you. And we're going to get you banned. If we can't lock you up, we'll try and get you prevented from getting a job or losing a job that you've got. I mean, it's absolutely disgusting. And the only document that I can go to that prophesies this is the Book of Revelation and other prophetic books of the Bible. So, in a lot of ways, worse is better, because at least it reinforces our faith. But it's a very rocky road ahead, and it's like being on a roller coaster ride. You're going up and down and up and down, and here we are telling the truth. As we were told to, I'm sure most of the audience who are similar age to me or older, we were told to tell the truth at school, told not to tell lies. And now we're being told that if we don't obey laws that are based on lies, then we're the bad people and we need to be dealt with. I'm speechless, Paul, so I hand over to you.
Yeah, I think it's the nub of it. It's very much this control of language, isn't it, about who can and who cannot supposedly say this and say that. Just going back to the thing about Rybakov, if I've said his name right, regarding the truth is no evidence in a court. My conclusion from that statement would be, therefore, that what he's referring to as a court is not a court. And therefore, they don't have a legal system that we are bound to. You see, everywhere you are supposed to go, it seems to me that there's always an implicit assumption that they want you to make whenever they make these statements that binds you in and you struggle a bit, but you can't say that. Well, they have said that. Our job now is to start laughing because it's not a court. A court's not where that goes on. You could say that any judge who is in a building where a supposed trial is taking, and they're calling it a court, where that kind of arrangement is at play, it's not a court. Not only is it not a court, he's not a judge. Not only is he not a judge, all the officers in that room are not officers in a court of law, because no law is taking place. Because if you forbid truth in a court of law, you haven't got a court. It's as simple as that. And that's what they're talking about. And of course, they're only talking about forbidding truths that would harm their interests. In other words, if they had told deceptions or laid in lies or propagated historical untruths for a certain period of time, which we suspect is, you know, highly likely the case, you can't have a court of law that's going to reveal that, because that's then classed as hate speech. We're then to go into an emotional trance. Oh, we can't hate people. You know, the whole thing is like a domino effect on the mind. And this is that Talmudic law at play of situational ethics. If it works to tell the truth on Monday in a court case, but it works to lie on Wednesday, that's what will occur. And you're not supposed to call it out, because that's hate speech. You're actually interfering with people. It's a bit like being angry with a shark for biting your leg off. And they're saying, well, don't get angry with the shark. It's just sharking. That's what sharks do, you know. You don't pick on the shark. You're hurting its feelings. Huh? My leg's kind of more important. Sorry. I'm going to kill it. That's what's going to happen. So... I kind of think that's it. Where is the basis of this control? If we say that the law courts are the absolute final port of call for ascertaining and determining truth in any situation, whatever type of case it is, but we find out that there's some kind of program at play, as you've indicated here, to ensure that truth under certain circumstances for certain people is not to be placed into the court as evidence, then we don't have courts, and we're not beholden to going to them, to listening to them, to, you know, when they make a summons, it's an interesting word, isn't it? Because summons is also what you do when you're summoning demons from the pits of hell. We're all familiar with that phrase from stories and things. Well, it's the same sort of thing. You don't have to actually respond to a summons, as far as I'm aware. By the way, I'm not asking people here to break the law. What I am saying is we need to get to grips with it more fully. And I suspect that once you've got through a lot of that gibberish and clutter, the over-verbosity of it, the nuanced, specific language that they have created for their own arena, purely to confuse you, the prospective plaintiff, defendant, or whatever you might be, once we've got through that language, we find out that the whole thing is effectively a form of black magic, in the sense that people that go into those spaces are cast into a blackness, a darkness. There's no light there for them to ascertain understanding, to get to grips with what is being taking place there. And that's what this is all about. And it begins, always begins, with this control of language, with this demonizing of words, with you can't say this, but we can. And the situational ethics thing with Talmudism is that basically there's one law for them in their mind, and there's one law for us in their mind. And I'm fine with that. I don't have a problem with them thinking like that. The idea is that when they actually want to put it in practice, we start laughing. You know, this is not a court law. And you're doing it in the wrong place. And you're not even English or American or whatever. Go and do your Talmud law thing where you want to do it. You've got Israel. You can Talmud away like Billy out there. Go on. Good luck to you. We're not coming and we're not interested. That's really my sort of a key part of my internal thought process is when I look at this stuff. I mean, this could all be just hot air that I'm blowing. I do understand this, Andy, that when pressure comes down on people, we buckle. And they know that. They know where the pressure points are. You were saying just then that they will apply force to individuals to get them to lose their jobs. Well, what we are lacking is a counterforce. So that if they begin that process, they know that five times the amount of force is going to come back at them. It's the only way. It's the only way. There's no other way. Because language with these people is continually twisted out of context again and again and again. And we're not, you know, I've touched on this before, we touched on it here before, there isn't any communication taking place between us. None. There's absolutely none. So we shouldn't even be sort of involved with it, it seems to me.
Well, it's interesting because you talked about Talmudism, and of course it brought to mind on March the 20th, this goes back to 1991, under pressure from the rabbinical Chabad-Lubavitch movement, the 102nd Congress of the United States passes Public Law 102-14 to designate March the 26th, 1991 as Education Day USA, in respect of educating the public to the seven Noahide laws from the Talmud, which are merely what the Pharisees derived from specific passages in the Torah. Furthermore, there are laws that only non-Jews have to follow. The focus of Public Law 102-14 being an education day is merely a smokescreen to fool the public into believing that the seven Noahide laws were not actually passed into law within this act. Instead, the Jews want the public to believe that this public law only introduced a one-off, not annual, day of March the 26th this year to educate people about this subject. However, it's rapidly obvious that a government-sponsored one-off education day does not require a law passed to ensure its implementation. Therefore, the laws were passed on March 20th, 1991, in readiness for when the United States courts wish to use them. And here are the seven Noahide laws. One, do not worship false gods. Well, who's a false god to Talmudists? It would be Jesus Christ. Yes. It would be for Muslims, it would be the Prophet Muhammad. Two, do not murder. Well, I've got no problem with that, but what's their definition of murder? Three, do not steal or kidnap. Four, do not be sexually immoral. Five, do not bless God, if euphemistically referring to blasphemy. Six, do not eat any flesh that was torn from the body of a living animal. And seven, do not permit oppression or anarchy to rule. Set up a system of honest, effective courts, police and laws to uphold the last six laws. Well, again, oppression or anarchy to rule, that's what we've got at the moment, isn't it? Because as soon as the members of the public come out with evidence that goes against the mainstream media push, they're being threatened, as I say, I mean, you know, this is why the memes are so powerful. When you get a meme that says they don't want you to have free speech, so they invented the term hate speech to shut you up. I can't think of any examples here of where this isn't the case. I mean, you know, we're seeing it all over at the moment. And the other thing I found interesting here is the violation of any one of the seven laws subject to Noahide is capital punishment by decapitation. That's from Sanhedrin 57a of the Talmud. And again, these laws or the education they link to them receive no criticism from the American Civil Liberties Union, which one would have expected, as not only do they represent the enforcement of a particular religion's edicts upon all non-Jewish people, but they also violate the ACLU's long-held belief in the separation of church and state. And I think it's interesting, you do have laws, I mean, in the UK a while ago, it was still on the books that possession of cannabis was against the law, but they decided not to prosecute people. Do you remember that? It was when David Blunkett was in charge, I believe, was Home Secretary, rather. And so, even though the law's on the books and you can't have them, if the government decide that they're not going to apply those laws, then they just won't apply them until they get the laws changed. In the same way, you could work this in the sense that these are signed into law when they want to use them. And that's the way that I see the Noahide laws in America, because why would you sign something into law for the purpose of an education day? And how come we haven't had this education day on a manual basis? I can only find reference to this going back to 1991. Paul, what are your comments?
What did you say? So there's seven of these whims. They're not laws. We've got they're just stuff made up by a bunch of blokes with beards. It's rubbish, and they need a good laughing at and tomatoes pelting at them for being so arrogant, but ho-ho, nothing's going to change. What did you say the penalty was for breaking any of them?
Decapitation.
All of
them? Yeah.
All right, and what's the first one again? Could you just read me the first one again?
Do not worship false gods.
Well, then all the Jews are going to have to decapitate themselves, aren't they? Because it says, what's the quote? You've got it somewhere.
No, because these only apply to non-Jews. You see, this is one. I see where you're going with it. But
it's easy then. Okay, right. Well, we'll all become Jewish then. Fantastic. I'm a Jew then, Andy. If they can make stuff up, so can we, right? Oh, he's mad. I think that the words that I'm interested in are Noahide. Why did they pick that? Oh, it's got to be resonant with some authority from the Bible, a book which they are completely unfamiliar with and has nothing to do with them. So we can laugh that one out of our courts, you know. And they're not laws. We don't need any laws from these people. We've got all of our, we've got the Ten Commandments, that's fine, thank you very much. And, you know, just because you've got long beards and large hats doesn't mean that you know anything. In fact, quite the opposite. So these people are committed to fiddling around with and bending and warping language to such a degree that we are supposed to go, ooh, wise men. They're clever men, but cleverness is not wisdom. And that's the distinction, I would say. I mean, how are we going to have to deal with this? The main problem, of course, is the weak-minded saps amongst us that inhabit political power and keel over to this nonsense. Signing documents, sitting around grinning at cameras, saying the Noahide laws have been written into law. No, they haven't, because they're not laws. This is just a hobby. And we have to find the language to strip this down. You know, we need to be like, what's his name, Carlin, the comedian, and just take these things apart. They need to be taken apart. And so I don't really, I don't pay attention to it for the reason that I think it's a joke, but I suspect most people don't pay attention to it, A, because they're not promoting it fully, but it feels like a sort of dormant demon that they're seeking to insert into the substrata of our law, and it's going to rise and rise until they can, yaha, now we're in charge and we can chop your heads off. You know, we've seen these, I mean, I don't know whether it's fear-mongering as well. I've seen lots of photographs of guillotines that have been installed in American penitentiaries and all this kind of stuff, apparently. I have no way of checking whether this is true or not. So there's been all this sort of stuff milling around for the last couple of decades, really. But are they laws? No. You know, so they've got laws that apply to the non-Jew. Okay, well, we'll come up with laws that apply to Jews. Let's make them up. We'll make seven up of our own, shall we? And call them laws. What should we call them? I can't think of a name right now. Competition. Right. We'll come up with the seven laws that countermand their stuff. And, you know, what should we have as a penalty, Andy? Beheading by guillotine? What do you think? savage language. I mean, if you and I were to come out with something like that and say, look, there's a series of laws that we wish to implement, which apply to non-white people, and if you break them, we'll cut your head off. I wonder how far we'd get with that in public discourse. Not very far at all, would we? So, you know, that's it. That seems to me what's going on. The minute we take this stuff seriously, it seems to me, is the minute it starts to bind on the mind. And they're then in the position of being able to amplify the fear and concern that has taken place once you take it seriously. And I'm not talking about dismissing it. I'm fully conscious of it. But we have to handle it in a particular way. We have to handle it like that lad handled Howard on the street. You are. It needs some real blunt sort of in your face. You're joking, are you? Seriously. That's the way I think it sort of... It removes from them the veneer of authority that they're seeking to clad themselves in, which they don't have. They have no right to it. It isn't theirs. They're never going to get it. This is a theatre production. And if we get sucked into the theatre, we're like a vulnerable audience. Time to stop playing that role, really, I think. I think that's part of it. You know. And I'm reminded of that phrase by Edmund Burke, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. I think there's a word you could change. I saw somebody change one word in that, and it made still a great deal of sense. And they said, particularly for these days, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men say nothing. Speaking now is the duty of all of us, to speak with energy and jollity and precision in the face of this nonsense and get it rebuffed, you know. And it's not the other side that we're making these communications for the benefit of. I wouldn't expect them to respond or do anything. It's for our kith and kin to know that we can communicate in this way, in the face of this stuff, so that it projects out amongst the listeners, metaphorically speaking. Yes? There's a great deal to be said, and it's all worth saying. And we're here to develop the white voice, the voice of the white people, you know, and for ourselves, that's all it is. Good luck with your Noahide whims, because that's all they are.
Yes, and I find it interesting because Undertaker's all the way back to 1776, the formation of the Illuminati under Adam Weishaupt, May the 1st, the old May Day there, Communist Consolidation Day. And the first, it's four parts, I'm not going to read them all, but on the first part you've got used monetary and sex bribery to obtain control of men already in high places. And then the second part is about cultivating students of exceptional mental ability in colleges and universities to train them to follow the Illuminati, giving them scholarships and what have you. And then you've got the influential people trapped in the coming under the control of the Illuminati, plus the students that we just mentioned, getting them in government positions as experts and specialists, etc., to shape the government to what they want. And then the fourth one, to obtain absolute control of the press. I repeat, absolute control of the press. That's why when I used to jump up and down about the fact that I understand it's six conglomerates control 96% of the world's media, and they won't even let us have our 4%. Well, they want absolute control, in the same way that when Jeremy Corbyn won't agree that calling Israel's, any criticism of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, he won't sign on to that in the international definition of anti-Semitism, even though he'll sign on to all the rest that we can disprove elements of. He's anti-Semitic because he won't go for everything, you see, and that's why they pushed that. But the reason I brought up the monetary and sex bribery is, in the UK, it seems slightly different. I think a lot of our politicians seem to get things after they serve, okay? Now, we had Norman Lamont, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, when our interest rates went up to 15% in the day and the pound crashed, and that's when Soros made all his money back in the early 1990s, and all these people were saying how stupid Norman Lamont was, and he was a terrible Chancellor, the worst we had. And what was his next job? He was a director of N.M. Rothschild & Sons, okay? He's now a Lord. And so a guy that's supposed to have done all this damage to the country is being given these accolades. And Paul, if you ran a big merchant bank, would you want someone on your board that had just crashed a currency? Okay, you'd have to say to yourself, well, I wouldn't want him unless that was part of the plan and he was merely a pawn in the game. And I looked at Tony Blair because, again, you have to look at this video again last week, why these people are doing what they're doing. Five former prime ministers, never seen it before, talking about a particular issue, all being dragged out of from wherever they've been residing over the past few years to talk about a special interest group out there. And then I look at Tony Blair. I did a search here, and I just typed into google.com Tony Blair net worth. Now, I've got, firstly, an article comes up from 12th of June 2015 from the Daily Telegraph, and it says Tony Blair worth a staggering £60 million. But then there was another later article from the Daily Express. This was 4th of January 2018, and I had to open that one up, but it said it was about £30 million. So they're saying he's lost half of it in 3 years, so I don't know quite what's going on there. But my point is, even on 30 million, I believe that the Prime Minister's getting, what, about 150,000, 160,000 a year, certainly back then. So how does someone who gets that amount of money, let's call it 200,000 a year, so let's give him a straight 2 million that he's got to pay tax on over the 10 years that he was Prime Minister of this country. How does that become even 30 million, never mind 60 million? What goes on with these people where they suddenly seem to get all this money after they've served? And I'm sure that people around the world, in Australia and the United States and throughout Europe and wherever people are listening, will have experienced similar things with politicians in their countries who seem to suddenly get a load of money after they serve. Wouldn't that indicate that they're being rewarded maybe for services to organisations other than the people, Paul?
Well, it would. I think the operative word, of course, is served. Served what? Served who? The people of the nations that elected them? Unlikely, it would seem, looking even at a casual glance at the evidence over the last decades. You know, you rarely get in. What are we supposed to say about our leaders here, supposedly our political leaders in Britain for the last 50 years? Even Margaret Thatcher. You know, you look at her. There's so much junk wrapped around that woman as well, you know.
She sold off all
ministers that were paedophiles and things like this. You know, having Jimmy Savile over for Christmas 13 years in a row, seriously. We're talking about revolting.
Yeah, just very quickly, that what a lot of people don't know, because people, and I understand this because folks, you know, the Iron Lady, all this sort of stuff, but what people overseas don't always know is that Thatcher sold off all our public utilities. And so, you know, the electricity used to be run by, you know, it was a non-profit organisation, it was the government. Same with even our telecommunications, it was then just landline phones then. And then we had the company BP, British Petroleum. And she was selling off left, right and centre. Of course, these actually, when I say not-for-profit, they did make money that went back in to help run the government. But of course, they were sold off and then, conveniently, only a few years later, in 1991, we had this massive stock market crash. So these shares could all be picked up for pennies on the pound. So this is how the whole thing seems to be engineered. And so someone who goes and sells off all your public utilities is not a good person for your country. Sorry to interrupt, Paul. Please continue.
No, it's a really relevant point, Andy. No, it's an excellent point. What he made me think of was how the media at the time, because I remember it going back to the 80s, were heavily promoting the privatisation of all of these utilities. And so we see, you know, a thread of power here is that the media, the more I look at it, is the most powerful of all the channels. Because if something is not right to the likings of the globalists today, they simply switch on the printing presses, inform the editors of where we're going to go, and 2 years later, with a barrage of bilge or whatever they have to, an admixture of truth and lies, they're able to shift public perception to support something that will not be in the interests of the public. They will perceive it another way. It's that powerful. And of course, much of its power is to do with the sheer weight of repetition and the budgets. I mean, just coming back to this thing as well about Blair and others retiring with vast sums of money. This obviously happens. I suspect they have coteries of advisors that manage their portfolio and all this, that, and the other. You know, they become high net worth individuals in the jargon of the day. Good luck to them. But I think it's also got a secondary benefit to the other side, which is to rub our noses in it. It reaffirms the fact that they were lousy leaders and they still got rewarded for it. And that's going to carry on, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that there's another power at play, which there is. And all of these things that we're touching upon here, I suppose in simple terms, come down to either politicians are for their nation, they don't exist much anymore. They do in Eastern Europe at the moment, in places like Hungary. Or they have been coerced into the globalist vision of stupidity, and they're all coerced into that. This is why the political establishment, certainly in a crystal clear way over here, is self-evidently against the interests of the people. Because the people of this nation were finally asked something in 2016 and said, we don't want to be part of the European political union. That's really what they said here. We don't want that. We're happy to trade, and we are Europeans. We're the British leg of it, and we're happy and want to interact with Europeans. We like it. But we don't want to be governed by their mugs. We want to be governed by ours. We might be able to get at them, back at them at some point, you see. And they have willed for 3 years, literally, all that's happened. Forget all the details and all the nuancing and the exhausting windbags that go on and on and on about it. They've simply refused to do it. They haven't done it. Because they're globalists. That's it. So that's, you know, if we were to draw the line in political language, that's how we would put it. We would say, you're either for your nation to operate as an independent nation, or you're a globalist that believes you can't possibly survive without being dependent on all the other nations of the world. And that word interdependence, there was a guy, what's his name, Stephen Covington or something? No, not Covington, I can't remember. Some professor or something wrote a book about, you know, the X laws of interdependence, and it was saying that this is really, really great. And I thought, it's not great. You don't need any of it. It's absolutely ridiculous. The whole idea of interdependence, of course, makes individual countries manipulable. You can cut them off from a resource and then apply political power to get them to change things to your globalist liking. And they'll buckle because, you know, there might not be any food in the country within inside 4 months or something, or no wheat or stuff like that, because they don't grow their own wheat. So this is part of the machinations of this plan. Interestingly, in these islands, we've got everything that we need to survive. If we got organized, you know, we have to recall the Navy to defend the islands. And we have plenty of land to grow plenty of food. It's a complete lie that we can't grow enough food. It's total rubbish. It's always been that way. There's masses of arable land here. It's just not accounted for. It's just spread all over the place. And we could get organized. But the media, just coming back to this point again, the media is the key thing. It changes perception. And once perception is changed, people's behavior changes in line with this newly appointed perception. And away you go. And so we end up effectively nullifying ourselves. And coming back to then the title of this show, you know, to make so-called hate speech forbidden is part, a key part of this process of shutting down critical thought in the populace so that you can manipulate them more efficiently. This is all about systems and efficiency and manipulation. That's all they're interested in. So that they can get everything under one control button, effectively. That's the drive for it. So, you know, as George Carlin said, they don't want an educated, questioning populace. And we do want that. We are people that absolutely want that. So we have to find a way of amplifying what we're saying and reaching more and more people. And that goes for the listeners too. So that we get more and more people asking questions in a polite but firm way. And that's where our strength lies. And we can defeat this thing. We have to believe that we can. It makes getting out of bed each day that much more pleasant, I find.
Yes, indeed. You know, these are trying times, but we just have to keep getting the message out there, and we have to be reactive to what they do. It's very tempting to just, you know, go off in the deep end, and, you know, it's very frustrating the way that they restrict our communications, and it's very easy to lose your temper, as some people do in chat rooms and that, and you have to watch that. We all have to watch that, because, of course, when you look at the